Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, welcome to Sunday night on ABC Radio, Radio Australia, ABC Digital and the World Wide Web. John Cleary with you as Australia claims a longed-for victory in the cricket. And we get to say hello to all our regular listeners on ABC Local Radio. As the worst of the global financial crisis passed Australia by, we've been able to immerse ourselves in the politics of simple point scoring. Thanks to the mining boom, the wealth of the nation as measured by the GDP is headed ever upwards. Well, so it seems. Perhaps that's a view only from the top end of town. Two reports released in recent weeks sound a cautionary note. Last week, Sydney's Wesley Mission launched Making Ends Meet. And a couple of weeks prior, the Salvation Army published Perceptions of Poverty, a look at disadvantage in Australia today. Both reports present a picture of an emerging two-track Australia, and it's not the east-west divide of the mining boom. It's a two-tier rich-poor divide that is widening across the nation and is most evident in our major cities. The salvos provide an overview. Wesley targets specifics, especially the social cost of easy credit and consumer expectations fueled by the electronic tube in our living room. But of course, analysis is only part of the picture. The Good Shepherd Foundation is one of those organisations providing innovative approaches to social and community development. And in a few moments, we'll be joined by the Reverend Keith Garner of Wesley Mission, Will McGallay of the Salvation Army, and Michelle Sainsbury of the Good Shepherd Foundation to have a chat about the state we're in and what we might do about it. But the background to much of what we're discussing tonight is the global financial crisis. And before getting down to the nitty-gritty as it affects Australia, the impact has been worldwide. Keith Garner, you've just returned from a church's conference in Africa. Did the issue of the GFC and the continuing impact of world poverty feature in that conference at all?
Well, that was the third Lausanne conference that began in Switzerland, a second was held in the Philippines in 89. And this is a major congress, really, on evangelisation and its link with the world and global issues. What was quite clear to me is that this was very much an African conference. It's almost as if the centre of gravity has changed over the years. One used to believe, in Christian terms, even if you didn't like it, that the centre of gravity was in America somehow when it came to mission.
Yes, it used to be Christendom in Europe, then it was America and God, and you're saying now Africa seems to be...
I think, in all honesty, the Congress was very much focused on there, and poverty is a real issue across the continent. Poverty, AIDS, and some of those phenomenally huge subjects that we seek to handle. And it was a very exciting Congress, and one in which I think the church was very much positioning itself to be alongside those that were poor and those in need. And it was quite obvious from the French-speaking Africans and people from North Africa, as well, of course, as the huge Asian church that was present at that 4,000 people part of the Congress. And I think that you're right in saying that global financial issues, I don't think that really if you're in Tanzania you talk about the price of the interest rate on the global. You just know there's not enough food on the table. You just know that poverty is a reality and that it's getting more difficult to do real things for real people.
It's interesting, and it is probably appropriate with the Salvation Army participating in this discussion as well, in that the Wesleyan tradition, of which you're a representative and certainly the Salvation Army is an inheritor of, do have this concern about both this world and the next built into their DNA, as it were.
Of course, and it seems to me that more and more people will become frustrated if their religion is merely focused on the hereafter. It's only really when we start to get down to the bread and butter of how we live life now that we begin to understand the breadth of God's salvation in all that it came to be. And it seems to me that that's what we're about. At Wesley Mission, we offer the good name of Jesus, but it makes no sense in offering that name unless you're serious about people's lives. And I often think of Daniel Niles, the great Sri Lankan Christian, who said evangelism is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. And I think from that culture comes an enormous amount for us.
Wilma Galley, it's probably an appropriate place to pick up the discussion with you. The Salvos report, Perceptions of Poverty. You're suggesting that the sort of national measures of economic health, such as those things we use in Australia, like gross domestic product and other things, risk masking something going on in the suburbs, that all is not well.
Absolutely, John. What we've done in this report is bring together a whole lot of research about poverty and disadvantaged, and together with some studies we've done with frontline staff who are providing crisis support to people coming in poverty to Salvation Army for assistance. And the report tells us that there are over 2 million people in Australia who are living in relative poverty. So 1 in 10 people are struggling. And relative poverty means deprivation. So it might mean that a family needs to go without meals in order to buy a school uniform or to pay the gas bill or the electricity bill. And Salvation Army has certainly seen an increase in the people who are coming to us for help, including people who have jobs. So we're starting to see people who are becoming known as the working poor. So in the past, Salvation Army used to predominantly help people who were receiving Centrelink benefits, but increasingly people who have a job are finding themselves in poverty as well.
So what you're suggesting is that the GDP, which is measuring Australian financial health, basically says, look, we're very well off. We've escaped the global financial crisis, and things are terrific for us. If that's the case, are you suggesting that perhaps the GDP isn't an adequate measure of what's going on?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the factors, I mean, certainly our unemployment rate is much lower than what we see in America and Britain and parts of Europe, something like 5%, and that's a good thing. But we've got a growing pool of underemployed people, so something like 800,000 or 7% of the workforce are people who want more work, whose income is insufficient for them to get by. And some of the other statistics.
So what are we saying is the cause of this? Are you going to any causal factors?
One of the most significant causes of poverty and financial hardship in Australia is the lack of affordable housing. So we've got a housing shortage, and some of the people that are coming to agencies like the Salvation Army and others for help are paying 30, sometimes 50% of their income in accommodation costs. So whether that's rent or mortgage costs. So when you factor into that increasing energy bills, rising cost of food, and just the general expenses in household bills, people are really struggling, and at the end of the pay period haven't got enough to make ends meet. So they're juggling their bills, sometimes going without. There's certainly no money left over for luxuries in the people that we're working with.
Keith Garner, that brings us back to the sorts of concerns that your Wesley Mission report is showing, particularly in the area of financial management and how, when things are getting tight, people are just lacking the resources and the tools as much as anything.
Yeah, we've done a number of studies now over a number of years, and we've taken financial stress as the marker, and people sort of argue a bit about what does this mean. And I think it's paying for essential bills. If you can't pay for your utility bills, you're under stress. If you can't repair your car in a state like New South Wales or some of the Northern Territory, if you didn't have that ability, you'd be under stress. Now, the reality is that many people find no way out of that. They don't seek help, and many people rack up bills during this time. And I suppose the political angle of all this, and where the sharp edge comes, is I think we have to be brave enough to say, you know, that somebody has to draw a line in the sand and start debating how this impacts upon legislation. How does this impact upon the availability of credit, which is being made available to people who just can't afford it? We've called on people to take seriously warnings that should be given to people, and whether it's possible for people to have 5, 6, 10, 20 credit cards. All of that really impacts upon further than just philanthropic organisations like ourselves. I think there's a prophetic element to this, and we need to say it, and to say it very swiftly.
There's actually a broader cultural issue at stake, you're suggesting here. One of the things you point to is the pervasive way in which the society itself is structured. That is, it's a society that depends on the consumer, and the consumer is king, in a way.
And the instantaneous availability of more and more credit.
Now, to feed the voracious consumer.
And one just feeds on the other, and it goes round in circles. But I think there are some serious other issues. I think the ethical issue is that we do live in a pay now culture that we've pushed to one side to have now, pay later. Yes. And I think there are people on both sides of politics that are saying we need to become a savings culture again. You talked about the Wesleyan roots, and later on we're going to be talking about people having the ability to be able to pay for things. I think we need to be able to save again, and I think somebody needs to say that. A simpler Christmas is another message we've called for. I mean, just look at the kids, what they're expecting for Christmas.
Yes, Christmas is now the celebration of the sacred consumer, isn't it? I mean, it's almost lost its religious. It's become a celebration of consumption.
And I think it's not too late to call a halt on that and actually change a new way.
Little Cromwellian thought coming in there.
I'm not suggesting that we don't smile anymore, you know, John. I will sing the odd carol now and again.
Michelle Sainsbury, let's bring you into the conversation here, because the Good Shepherd Foundation specialises in the sort of assistance on credit and finance matters we've come to associate in some ways with the third world countries that Keith Garner was alluding to earlier, microfinance and such. Are we really seeing the emergence of a market for such services in Australia?
Thanks, John. Good Shepherd's been involved in the delivery of microfinance programs for 30 years, interestingly, around the same time that the Grameen Bank was founded in Bangladesh. And for us and our partners in the community sector, it's almost a human rights issue. It's access to safe, fair and affordable financial services. And that dignity, respect and justice that we would hope for all Australians. So absolutely, microfinance in a developed economy is relevant. I would probably add that the issue of poverty has existed in prosperous times as well as through the global financial crisis. And we've certainly experienced that people are financially excluded. There's a particular issue around gendered exclusion and women who face exclusion to the financial services that are available within the community.
So single mothers, etc., those sorts of people are marked down by financial institutions. That's rather
absolutely. If anyone living within Australia who is in receipt of Centrelink payments and has a healthcare card is immediately excluded from accessing mainstream loan programs. So the no interest loan scheme, which we've delivered for now 30 years and have some 400 locations across Australia, is I guess an alternative to that, where people can access low loans with no interest and no fees, and that is I guess the response to the challenges that particularly single mums face to raise funds in a time of crisis. For example, the washing machine breaks down or the fridge, or they have a young child that now needs a computer, and where do you raise funds? Where do you raise $1,200 in an emergency for that type of asset, which probably many Australians take for granted?
Michelle, the banks are taking a bit of a hit at the moment, particularly for raising interest rates at the same time as having been effectively underwritten by the government during the global financial crisis. It's not all bad news in that direction, though. You've recently launched a scheme in the inner suburbs of Melbourne that one of the big banks is getting aboard.
We're incredibly excited about this. Just over a week ago, the Victorian government announced a commitment to a concept that Good Shepherd, in conjunction with its corporate partner, the National Australia Bank, had been hatching for some 2 years. And we'll be seeing the emergence of three community finance hubs called Just Finance, the first being in Collingwood in the new year. So that opportunity, I think...
So what will they do?
They'll provide, a front door, the high street access to products, whether they be credit, safe, fair and affordable credit products, or services or referral advice and advocacy to the services that are available within local communities. Unfortunately, there is a lot available, but people don't know. And in the absence of that knowledge, people are forced to rely on precarious lending situations that get them in further debt. So this Just Finance, as we like to refer to these hubs, is going to be a way for us to test a theory, and that is that if you have a place that is on the high street that sits alongside the non-mainstream lenders, that people will be able to make a choice and have those that information and services available to them.
Keith Garner, I'll come back to you in a moment because your report too goes to the sorts of remediations we may provide here. But Wilma Gallo, just before we talk about some of these solutions that or recommendations that Wesley are making, when the Salvos are looking at this sort of stuff, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, is it? I mean, whilst financial management may be appropriate for some or even microfinance for others, there's a sort of assumption out there in some quarters that all you need to do is provide people with the means and they can do it for themselves, that everybody's potential to be an entrepreneur.
Yes, and that is a concern, John, because some of the people that that we see daily have very complex needs and issues. So they might be homeless, they might have drug and alcohol dependency, relationship breakdown. They could be young people who had a poor start in life, who don't have the educational standards that will enable them to find good jobs and so on. And so we're finding that poverty, certainly income and finance is a significant factor, but there are a whole lot of other issues that contribute towards the complexity of poverty, and we need to address those underlying issues in order to help people to build their individual capacity and develop the resilience that they need to survive, to get by.
Do you think governments are sensitive enough about the issues we're facing at the moment, Wilma? Particularly, we've had Joe Hockey and Wayne Swan bashing the banks quite happily, but you're looking at other underlying costs rising too, like the cost of utilities around the country. I mean, electricity prices, because most state governments, apparently when they privatised the utilities, really neglected the fact that consumers were still going to have to bear the cost of any necessary upgrade, and governments are copping the odium whether they're privatised entities or not.
Yeah. And the horrendous increases in utility costs is evident in all of the case studies that we've talked about in the book. Certainly, government are looking at addressing poverty in a different way. We talk now about a policy framework of social inclusion, which accepts that poverty is a multidimensional issue and needs to be tackled.
They might accept it, but are they doing anything about it?
We're actually calling on the Commonwealth Government to put together a national child poverty strategy, because we just feel that not enough is being done to address the issue of child poverty, and the fact that one in seven children in Australia are growing up in poverty is of serious concern, because we know that that will impact on their social and emotional development. So we want to see the government set some targets. We want them to do similar things to what they're doing around the issue of homelessness, where they've set a bold vision to halve homelessness by 2020. We want to see that sort of vision in the area of child poverty in particular.
Keith Garner, you've got several recommendations which you're making to the government around the specific area of finance. I'd like to go through those in a moment. If you've just joined us, you're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. We're talking with the Reverend Keith Garner of Wesley Mission in Sydney, Wilma Gallo of the Salvation Army, and Michelle Sainsbury of the Good Shepherd Foundation. It's about poverty and finance in Australia. Are we entering a two-tier Australia where the rich and poor, the divide is widening, and the poor keep having the expectations of potential riches thrust upon them through the telly every evening, but perhaps it's making things worse? You might like to give us a call, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Are you feeling the pressure financially? Have utility bills got to you? Bank interest rates making a difference to your life? Are you finding that things are not as good as they once were? Do you think the government need to act, or do you think people need to just get on and look after themselves? Well, Keith Garner and Wesley Mission are suggesting it may be a bit of both. Keith, let's talk about some of the things you're suggesting.
Mm. And we're not quite as protective about government. Let me say that I think that part of our job is to actually challenge, not just offer suggestions. And I think I'd be prepared to say I think that looking at the banks in this country, they're in a very protected place compared to many other countries. You don't have to talk about North America because they never really had the big bank structure, but the UK's big four banks have fallen in terms of power. Australia's banks are still very
strong.
Well,
they were underwritten by the government during the GFC, and that still continues effectively. The government is guaranteeing the banks. The risk factor seems to be minimal for the banker.
And they certainly don't need us to protect them because I think they're doing well, and in many ways we've seen some of the salaries that have been declared, and they fight very well for themselves, it seems to me.
A $16 million a year salary, it seems to sort of, it's incomprehensible for most people.
Look, I think it is, and I think this is a bold thing to say, but you know, you might as well say it, haven't you, really? We're not talking to any individual here, but I think when you come to enough, enough's enough. I mean, when you have your nice house and your cars, there comes a point. And I think we probably have to rediscover in our culture again that there is more to work for than money. And
this comes back to a very big issue, of course, doesn't it? It comes back to the whole discussion about if society isn't operating under a tight moral framework, where are the limits? And you're suggesting there's a wider breakdown of a shared framework of value.
In the same way that, quite rightly, that Wilma's reminding us, and of course we practice that through our financial counselling and work with the homeless, that there is more to a problem than just one aspect. Mm. You know, it's a much more integrated human experience. In the same way, when we talk about what are the drivers for living, I think it's much more than that. But you asked me about the things that we're suggesting. Financial counselling, we certainly need more resources there. I think we also have to take away the community stigma that's associated with looking for help, because that's one of the things that's certainly there, as if something's really wrong if you have to go and see a financial counsellor, and supporting health outcome improvements. These are the kind of things that we're trying to talk about.
So it's a holistic approach.
Certainly, and it's not just one cap fits all, and it's not one aspect, but it's many, many aspects of which government need to be a part.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Let's take a call from Odin in Queensland. Hello, Odin. What would you like to say?
Oh, how are you tonight?
Yeah, very well.
Yeah, look, I just sort of wanted to say, you know, that the poverty situation in this country is it's getting ridiculous, you know. Like, disability pensioners, they get $15,000 per annum. And people on the unemployment, they get about $12,000 a year. And, you know, that works at about $1,400 a month, which is like to cover absolutely everything. And the thing is, Australia spends about $26 billion with a B, $26 billion per annum on the military budget. That's about 2% of the GDP. Works out to be about $1,000 for every man, woman and child in this country. And the thing is, I just sort of don't understand how society really accepts this kind of expenditure that goes out, you know, and not to mention sort of like, you know, sort of past projects that never even got to see the light of day, where there was just like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that were just wasted. And, you know, I mean, there's old age pensioners here who spent a lifetime paying taxes, and surely we owe, if nothing else, surely we owe these people.
Well, we'll pick up on a couple of the points you raise there. One of the points you make is that we seem to have become a sort of bit more mean-spirited over the way we handle pensions of all sorts and government payments of all sorts. Wilma Gallo, you've had an interest in this over the years. Is that the case? Have we become a bit more mean-spirited or parsimonious in Australia over recent years?
Certainly. We are calling for, along with a whole lot of other agencies, a root and branch review of the social security system in Australia, because there are certain benefits and pensions that attract a judgment, a stigma. And in fact, we decided to do a community attitudes survey as part of this perceptions of poverty to find out how the general community felt about people on Centrelink benefits. And we found it coming through there. We asked whether or not benefits should be increased, and we found that generally the public were very strong on increasing pension rates for old age pensioners and people on disability support pension, but not as keen to see increases in sole parent pensions or the New Start allowance that unemployed people receive. So there's definitely a judgment about people on Centrelink benefits, and certainly the rates of Centrelink benefits are way below the poverty line.
Keith Garner, you're nodding your head there.
Well, I think, look, one of the things that comes out of our report is that single people, single parents in particular, are folks that are doing it tough. And I think really, it's not our business to get involved in the moral judgments about these things. These are children. It's next generation. And if in fact, we've got now young people who are in families where they have never known anybody in their family to ever work. And that in itself has all kinds of impacts. And I think we do have to stretch beyond where we are now. We have to look at the benefits that single parents have. And I think that there's a kind of feeling in Australia, you know, well, you know, these people, it's their own fault to some extent. Nobody says it quite like that, John. Yeah. And I've said it strong. Yeah. I think somebody has to speak up for them.
Yes. Do you think it's partly, and I'll ask this of each of you, Michelle, perhaps you can have a go at it first, the emergence of the beginnings of the emergence of a two-tier Australia, that is, we're an Australia where those who are really finding it tough are forced to the margins of the suburbs, and people who are reasonably well off never encounter them.
John, absolutely, and I think one of the things that we're seeing is that, as has been mentioned by Wilma and Keith, the cost of living is increasing, that the issues with housing, but particularly what we're seeing is the energy consumption costs, and you know, living on the fringes of sort of growing metropolises adds to the burden of those costs in terms of transport and access to services and support. So I think the two-tier system is probably coming out of a result of people looking to build big homes in outer-lying suburbs, but now they're bearing the cost of that with regard to energy, but also transport is a huge issue.
And servicing the mortgage. Keith Garner, let's talk for a moment about some of the specifics in your report. That is, you're recommending educational services being provided by church, by government, by community agencies. That is, and these educational services have to be intentional. It's no good the hit and miss. We have to actually get down into schools introducing courses in financial management as almost as fundamental as phys ed for kids.
Yes, look, Prime Minister Gillard, in the pre-election promise that she would take seriously, and I believe she will, the introduction of financial literacy as part of the normative programmes in schools. In other words, not something we do because we choose to do it, but because, in fact, this is norm to learn how to talk about mortgages, to learn how to talk about savings. And I think that will go an awful long way. In fact, the Liberal government of the past under people like Paul Clitheroe were involved in financial literacy, and certainly now that is continuing, but there needs to be an awful lot more of it, you know. It needn't be something privileged that we do. We need to talk about it very clearly, and I hope that that's really carried through, because it'll make a big difference. But I think the Christian Church, let's come back to the Christian Church and say we do have a role, and I think the local Christian Church, not just big agencies like the three of us that are sat here tonight with you, but the local church can play a great deal of a part here, of people sitting together talking about how they can help each other.
That goes back to recovering a sense of community. Now, it's something, of course, the Conservative government in Britain are very strong about. One, and it's a two-edged sword, as people are beginning to see. I mean, you've had Boris Johnson jump up and down the Mayor of London the last couple of days about the possible impact of a fracturing of community. So this idea of community, it can be used as both a way of uplifting people, but also a way of dividing people, of saying, well, government's washing its hands of that, folks. It's all now up to you. You go and rediscover community again.
And that was my danger of being too protective of government, really, because we want to stay sufficiently at arm's length as to be critical as well, because it seems to me that when the work is done, it's only just begun. You know, we really haven't begun to achieve those things. But I think there is a sense in which we can, hand in hand with the kind of legislative changes, governmental supported things, and those things we can do in community. One of the projects that we're involved in is helping people who come from countries, Arabic countries and parts of the Middle East, where we know that some of the women in those projects can't actually go to offices in the normal usual, so we've actually set up things to try and help them. Now, I think in community, all of us can do an awful lot more than we are doing, and we can also make sure that we don't catch the money bug.
And Michelle Sainsbury, this is the direct underpinning of the philosophy that you're operating under too, with the Good Shepherd Foundation.
That's right, John. The people that access our loan programs, our experience is that actually people on low incomes aren't poor money managers. They're in fact probably the most resourceful within our communities. They just don't have enough, as it has already been said by the caller. 97% of borrowers repay their loans with us.
How do you get that? How do you get people to buy in from people on that sort of thing?
Well, it's a relationship that's built on respect and trust, and there's an expectation that people repay their loans. This is not charity. This is a response to, as I said earlier, people not having access to services. So there's a microfinance worker that sits down with a person, looks at their financial situation. If they're not able to service that loan, then they don't get the loan.
So there is a one-to-one relationship there. It's a bit like the old bank manager, really, isn't it?
Well, yes, we possibly could talk about sort of, you know, a fifth bank through these microfinance programs. But I think, you know, it really is about that one-on-one relationship and really an identified need within a community that these organisations that establish no-interest loan schemes see. So they respond to what they see within their communities and they develop the program accordingly.
I mean, Abbey Road in London is known for two things. One, it was the Beatles studios where Apple Records was. And secondly, it was where in the Abbey Road Methodist Church, the Abbey Building Society began. As many of the great building societies, the trouble was many of those great building societies and savings and loans in the US, they grew too big for their own.
They got corporatised.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they were to help people in the first place to be able to buy or at least have a part share in something that would never be possible.
Let's take a couple more. Wilma, you want to say something there?
Oh, sorry, John. It was Michelle. I was just going to say that each no-interest loan scheme is run by a grassroots organisation. So the people accessing those loans programs aren't aware of Good Shepherd's involvement. They're not aware of who the provider is of capital. But just as Keith identified, it's very local-based and very organic within that local community.
Do you think community-based loans could help you? Give us a call, 1300 800 222. Vanessa is on the line. Hello, Vanessa. Welcome. What would you like to say?
I'd just like to say I kept out a cutting from the newspaper 2 years ago, how the minister vowed to evict troublemakers from housing estates. Now, if that happened, we could shift all these people along that families are in one-bedroom houses and one person are in, you know, review. You've all heard it before, a review of all these apartments. And it says 4 crimes are reported at Victorian Public House estates every day. Now, because we don't have reviews, we can't get these kids into a house to build their life in the first place. It's not that we don't have enough housing. We don't have enough review to get them a house. Now, the government has evicted at least 4 traffickers from the Fitzroy estate under a pilot program that cost $83.8 million on public housing security. Now, they didn't evict them. The police did. DHS will not review, go through every single house and review so they can stick these poor homeless kids that, or adults that are on the street, they could snap them in no time if they reviewed housing that families grow out of, go and get their own job, And we have got those families that don't know anything about except DHS, but they can be trained. We need more welfare workers that the government won't help. We need a holistic approach.
Well, you've given us a good overview of that. Wilma, without getting into specifics, does Vanessa raise some legitimate points?
Yes, I have had these points raised before where we need to do a review of tenancy within public housing, certainly. But there is still an issue about the number of public housing dwellings, and it has fallen over the last 10 years. And there's something like 180,000 households languishing on waiting lists right across Australia. So we need to build more houses. We need to do reviews of public housing as well to make sure that the... That people who are homeless get into affordable housing.
Thanks, Vanessa, for your call. Let's go to Pat in Wodonga. Hello, Pat. How are you?
How you going?
Good. What would you like to say?
Oh, mate, I was in reference to... I'm a person that owns quite a few homes and rents them out with mortgage rates and trying to give up rentals and all that sort of thing. In our area here... When you're a homeowner and an investor, you forever have a loss on properties.
Just not keeping up with the payments or damage to properties.
Well, my little portfolio cost me about $2,500 to $3,000 a month in losses.
Yeah, but what are the losses incurred through?
Incurred through interest rates and all those things against your income and your... you're forever catching up on tax losses. Now, the government don't realise how they're pernicious. With home ownership, it's a big thing, isn't it?
It is indeed. You're one of those that are concerned that the structure of finance isn't such that you can make a go of it, even though you've got enough money to have a portfolio of investments.
Yeah. And I think we need competitive banking.
Yes, so it's the banking issue you're coming back to.
It's a banking issue, and It's a simple reason that you've been controlled by people that sit in little offices and people that actually do not own homes, and they're your bank managers. And they don't understand where you're coming from. We're getting raped in this country by people that don't understand what the system is about.
Pat, thanks for the observation. More an observation than a question there about the nature of the banking industry. To Barbara. Barbara, welcome. What would you like to say?
I guess I'm in a bind. I'm a woman in my mid-40s. If I'm on a disability pension, I live on my own, so I have to fund everything myself out of my pension. So the capacity to earn extra income isn't there. Hang on, I'll just remove my charger. It's beeping at me. When you live in a rural area, you have to maintain a car. And while there are the low interest loans through Uniting Care Wesley in our area, they only do two applications in a month. And so if you have a crisis, it can be anything up to 8 to 12 weeks and not even guaranteed, even if you meet the criteria for the loan. And once you've got one, if something else goes wrong, you just don't have anywhere left to turn. As they said, on a disability pension, you're not accessible to the funds. And I'm in public housing, and when I got a small job that was paying me $20 a week, $5 of that went in increased in rent. Mm. And it's like, and so you don't even have an opportunity to get up to the poverty line before they take it away. And no one's putting away superannuation for me. I haven't had an opportunity in my working life because I damaged myself when I was 25, so I've spent a long time and on benefits and just watching more and more of my health falling apart, and within the health system there isn't the support for people in the Middle Ages. If you're young or you're under a particular banner like paraplegia or something like that, or cancer, you get funding. Or if you're an old person, but I've got 21 years to wait until I fit that criteria as well.
Barbara, you've described the situation quite graphically and referred Keith to one of your programs, Wesley Mission.
Sure. Look, Wesley Mission has been involved with trying to help people to handle situations that are way beyond the ability of any organisation to help. We quite rightly.
So Barbara's giving a good example of a multidimensional problem.
Yeah, she's giving an example too of the fact that you sort one thing out, and before you've even begun to sort that out, another's knocking at the door, and that's the reality of debt, and it's a very real one. And as was said earlier, we do have affordable housing crisis here in Australia. We must name it. We've been taking housing stock out of the ownership of the people and of governments and putting it into the private sector with all kinds of implications. Let me also say, I think that there are differences between regional and city areas, and I know that the calls that have been coming in have been from very different kinds of areas, and this kind of figure, 20 to 30% of the salary must be put aside for housing. Well, it's not as easy to place a rule across the country. In many areas, there's a very high percentage of people's income that needs to go to housing. So you might have the situation that you described earlier of these kind of fancy houses in places with no furniture inside, with no heating on, and with people hardly being able to live.
We'll take another couple of calls and then get into some final comments about where to from here. To Shay in Browns Plains. Hello, Shay. Welcome.
How are you tonight?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
I think we're all being severely conned by the banks. And I don't think there's any real question about that. I bought a house 4 years ago, and the interest rates started to drop, and the banks have made nice profits year after year. Yet what's going on now is they're saying interest rates have to rise because the financial market, the world market, etc., global financial crisis. Well, I borrowed the money. The house has been funded, paid for, etc., and that rate rise overseas is irrelevant to loans taken out prior to, say, 18 months ago.
Yes. I'll take it as a general comment, Shay, because you're making a comment that's reflecting much of what's been said in the press over recent days. It's also interesting to note that, of course, the impact of the global financial crisis in Europe, the UK and the USA, developed economies like ours, has meant that mortgage rates are a tad lower there than they are here. Yeah. Relatively speaking, our mortgage rates are pretty high.
Yeah, I think I'd like to just say that you have to put it against the background and the context of other particular challenges. I mean, this is the comment that's often made. If you go back to such and such a day, they were at this level. Yes, but they also didn't have upon them the pressures of utility bills as a percentage of income that they are now. Some of the other pressures on family life that are very real. And I think here's the warning. I think that if, in fact, there was a double dip around the world, if one hits Australia, remember, we didn't have a first to practice on. When it comes next time, it will come here for the first time, and I think a lot of people are going to be shocked.
Yes. To Michael in Muswellbrook. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, g'day, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
Well, I worked in the sort of Wallamaloo area with the homeless guys there, and now I'm based in Muswellbrook. We're the Christian Social Centre.
Yep.
And we've got a decent sort of low socio-economic area up there in South Muswellbrook, and I think, first of all, the churches have a lot to be ashamed of.
Why?
Sort of, well, they've sort of separated themselves from the community, I've found. So, like, they're not as much a part of the community as they should be and as they used to be. So slowly I hope they're starting to get back out there. But I've found, like, I think the problem what I see is it's a lack of care. Like, for example, right, you get a mum and she's got five kids. Now, those kids haven't got push bikes and they haven't got beds and they haven't got this and they haven't got that. Now, it takes one person to go up to the tip and buy a couple of good bikes, you know, for about $5 each. A bed, you can pick up a bed down at, like, a second-hand shop for a few bucks. You can take some stuff to the rubbish on the back of a truck, clean the yard up, you know, make them feel a bit better. And that just takes one person and a couple of hours. And that person feels a whole lot better, and they see a bit of an outlook, you know, they've been given a hand. So I think the money's not the problem. I mean, down here we've got Mount Arthur and this and that. They're throwing money at stuff. The amount the government put in, I mean, you could sit down and write government proposals all day and at the end of the year have enough money to, you know, start a small town. So the money's not the problem. The people don't really care. That's the harsh reality.
You've brought us back. You've brought us back, Michael, to almost the place we started at, and that is the sense of community and the capacity for local communities to renew themselves. And here, Keith, you alluded to the fact that the church can be central to this. Michelle, your observation about the way your operations through the Good Shepherd Foundation are running also captures this sense of community. Wilma, it's something that historically movements like the Salvation Army have been associated with. This is, Michael's basically saying, look, if the churches have a lot to answer for here, that the churches in a sense of, well, I guess let me push it a bit further, have become middle class. The churches are no longer in those poor communities in the sense that they once were, living with them.
Well, I suppose I hear that, but I also think of the larger states like Mount Druitt here in Sydney and other places where we have projects, and I'm sure the Salvation Army in some of these areas too. But it isn't my place to defend the church. We don't need to defend the church. What we need to do is to preach the good news. Now, what I mean by preach the good news, for me that means word and deed. It means to preach the good news that Christ cares for people, and the deed that we need to do something about it. And for me, the doing something about it is to help the vulnerable, to be alongside those in need and do practical things for, with and alongside, and call for legislative change to look at regulations and say, are these fair?
But Wilma, is there also a need to educate church congregations about what they can do locally?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there are some encouraging sayings, you know, particularly amongst young Christians. There is a real sense, you know, they understand the 2,000 verses in the Bible that talk about poverty and our responsibility to care for the poor and justice and so on. And we're seeing lots of examples of young people who want to be involved in a sort of an incarnational lifestyle where they do live amongst the lower socioeconomic areas and try to create a sense of community. And that needs to spread right across the Christian church so that we understand our responsibility to stand with and by people who are at risk of social exclusion and isolation because of poverty.
Michelle Sainsbury, your efforts are ones that are actually extending things in a very practical way, as some of the things that Keith is outlining are doing. To what extent are you seeing buy-in by others, by, say, the big end of town?
I think what it takes is strong leadership, and certainly where that is in place, we're seeing tremendous buy-in. But I think, you know, the Good Shepherd Sisters have a word that describes their actions, which is audacious. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in reflecting on Keith and Wilma's words there, we need risk takers within local communities that are prepared to be audacious, whether that's the high end of town, in the leadership there, or in local communities. People just need to be willing to step up to the plate and take the risks, because we have a problem, and that problem is not going to go away.
Thank you all for joining us tonight on Sunday Night. Keith Garner, let me just get one last reflection from you, and it's this risk of a two-tier Australia. You've come from England, which has been through infinitely more than we've seen, but you've also seen a society which has grappled with this philosophically. How you risk having a two-stream society, a society that's permanently divided by wealth and poverty. Do you see any chance of that in Australia? Do you see signs of that sort of ethos in Australia?
Oh, I think I'd be bold enough to say it exists. I don't see it as a danger. It exists. However, it exists more subtly, I think, in our community, in our society. The most seminal experience of my life was when my father was made redundant as a young person. And I see that happening in communities again and again. And I think we have to say, let's fight hard. In the old words of William Booth, we're in a war. And the war is a real, and we'll fight and fight and fight. And we have to do that.
Mm. Keith Garner, Wilma Gallo, Michelle Sainsbury, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night. And thank you to all for participating via the telephone. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio. We'll be back with you after the news with a completely different turn of events. We're going to explore God, a biography with Jack Miles, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and recent visitor to Sydney. Keith, Michelle and Wilma, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.